From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida. On our interfaith calendar, September 8th marks the Christian Feast of the Nativity of Mary. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
Our senior minister search committee has reached a point of unanimous decision for the Reverend Dr. Amy K. Butler to be our seventh senior minister of the Riverside Church.
How could we possibly summon the courage to step out again, to try to live into the promise of all God envisioned when she showed up on Pentecost and blew open the locks? Well, we start here.
Just in the past few months, we've seen women clergy move into the leadership positions of so-called tall steepled churches in New York, Washington, and Chicago. Is this a sign that mainline denominations are ready to abandon what's been called the stained glass ceiling? Dr. Diana Butler Bass will be here with some thoughts on these historic developments.
Going into the midterm elections, any issue will mean as much as Obamacare.
No, there's no issue that's going to touch it.
Organizations not officially linked to the candidates are spending at record levels.
Partisanship and party lines are so deeply ingrained that a vast majority of congressional races are over before they even begin.
Labor Day is behind us, so the countdown can officially begin. Yes, there are only 108 shopping days until Christmas. Wait a minute, that's the wrong countdown. Well, what I was trying to say was the countdown to November 4th has begun. And for a look at the issues most likely to drive the outcome of this year's midterm elections, I'll talk with Ring of Fire radio host Mike Papantonio. But first,
you may be surprised to learn who agents are catching trying to cross the border from Mexico.
ISIS coming into America, I would guarantee you they're already here.
Talking about moderate and peaceful Muslims, I'm glad you're here. But where are the others speaking out?
You either have to convert them or kill them. One or the other.
After the attacks of 9/11, 13 years ago this coming Thursday, if you can believe it, our nation witnessed an outbreak of fear, bigotry, and violence targeting Muslim Americans as well as American Arabs, Sikhs, and others. As the brutality of the terror group ISIS continues to claim lives and provoke widespread fear, even as another anniversary of 9/11 is upon us, I felt it was essential for us to talk about the toll that it's taking on Muslims to have their faith hijacked by extremists so relentlessly. I'm very grateful to be able to welcome Imam Muhammad Majid, immediate past president of the Islamic Society of North America. Not only a respected colleague, he is a cherished friend. Imam Majid, thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy. I appreciate it.
You know, it has to be extraordinarily painful to see one's faith tradition to be invoked by forces of terror. And so I want to begin, my friend, by asking you, what effect is this having on Muslim American communities?
Thank you for asking this question. Muslim community are really going through tremendous difficult time when they see this video of a man committing such a crime against their fellow American in the name of their religion, the name of the beautiful religion of Islam. And this image of someone claiming that he is Muslim and committing this crime in the name of Islam have a flashback of Muslims regarding 9/11 when Muslims have to ask themselves, what can we do to prevent such a tragedy from taking place again in our name and the name of Islam? What ISIS is doing is really creating great misconception, misunderstanding of beautiful religion of Islam, and therefore American Muslims once again find themselves addressing and answering questions about Islam. Is the religion of Islam is a religion of violence? is violence part of Islamic culture? What those people come from? Those are the questions that we find ourselves answering. Yeah. But I would like just to share with everyone that this makes us more resilient as American Muslims to say, this is not Islam, and we will do our best to protect our community and our children from joining such cult. Mm. For American Muslims, what this means for them is that we have to do more to encounter this narrative by teaching the true narrative of Islam, the meta-narrative of Islam, to our children, to our community, and to share that concept with our fellow Americans.
Mohammed, what is this doing to the kids in your community?
Oh, my goodness. Now, you know, the school have started in many states of the United States. And when the children go to school and there's images on TV regarding violence committed by people claiming they're Muslims, children being made fun of, there's bullying in the school. A young child, fourth grade and fifth grade, find themselves as if they are the clergy that have all the learning of Islam, because they have to respond and to answer questions. A child in middle school or in high school, they find themselves to be the Grand Mufti, which is the high clergy level in the Muslim world, by answering questions about Islam. It's horrible to see these images of violence, and the children have to be in the defense of and answering those questions about Islam when they go next day to school.
Mohammed, do you see Americans in general as having grown to understand the distinction between followers of Islam and those who attempt to hijack the name of the religion for their own destructive purposes?
I see there's some progress being made, especially with our interfaith partners. We have seen tremendous understanding among the people of other faiths who work with Muslims, mm-hmm. especially Christians and Jewish community. There's partnership being created in every level, I think, in the United States now between Muslims and people of other faiths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But still, there's so many people, they cannot differentiate between true Islam and what those people are doing. And that's why the gap is. The gap is that we need radio show like yours. We need people to write articles. We need people to engage with their neighbors, one-to-one. We need Muslim communities to open their mosque for the American neighbors to come in and to break bread with them and to talk to them so that they know who we are and what we represent. There's still a lot of work to be done. And media play a big role in addressing this issue.
Yeah.
That's why I do believe that there's some progress being made, but the gap is still wide and big.
I thought of you specifically because this television personality, Phil Robertson, who is a member of the larger community in which I live in Monroe, Louisiana, said to Hannity on Fox News when asked about how he would handle ISIS and that whole situation, and he said, "I would either convert them or kill them." And I shuddered that that kind of comment would be made by someone that claims to share the Christian faith as I hold it, knowing that that sends a message that we're just like the members of ISIS. That's what they say, convert or kill. And it just drove home how frustrated you must be all the time to hear a faith that you reverence and embrace passionately associated with that kind of damaging, detrimental hatred. How do you handle that, Majid?
I get a lot of support from people like you and other fellow Americans, Christian and Jewish, rabbis, pastors, who will say to me, "We know, Muhammad, Imam Majid, this does not represent you, does not represent Islam. We're grateful for all the work Muslim Americans are doing. Those are the people that we count on, and those people who represent really America and the beauty of this country.
Yeah.
And that's why America is unique from all other countries, being a country that opens its arms and accept diversity and pluralism. Therefore, when I hear someone like that say anything negative about Islam, to me, I said he does not represent the beauty of this country,
mm-hmm.
as well ISIS does not represent Islam.
Yeah.
Therefore, two mistakes do not make it right. That's I cannot pass judgment on my fellow Christians because someone who claims he's Christian says something hateful toward Muslims or Islam.
Yeah.
Because I know Christianity about love, but loving thy neighbors. I know my neighbors who are Christians, they have opened their arm to us when we move to the neighborhood. I cannot tell you how much we're grateful in the mosque where I'm the imam of the support we get from our fellow Americans. And I would like to remind my friends who are the Christian and Jewish listening to this, and people of other faith as well, that all of us, we hold the same principles of loving thy neighbor and not to bear false witnessing on our neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when we see hate, we should respond to it with love. Hate cannot drive hate. Only love can do that.
Right.
My message to my fellow Americans and people of other faiths, let us do the right thing.
Yeah.
Let us love one another, and let us be the one who create this resiliency in our community, where the love and care, it is the principle that all of us care about and hold.
Muhammad, how can Muslim faith leaders help other followers of Islam cope in the way that you have to cope?
After the tragedy of 9/11, I see that the faith community, really they show their best to one another, especially toward Muslims. Where we have Christian community after 9/11, when our mosque was vandalized, they came to us with flowers, with donations, and they spent the night in our parking lot protecting the mosque. This happened across America. This is the best of America.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, my dear brother, that I come to know the best of the United States when I work with you and other people in issues that concern all of us. When we care about the issue of people who are in tremendous need, poverty, hunger, health issues. Today, we've seen dialogue taking place in different places in the United States. In our area here, the Christians and the Jewish community, they've created a dialogue between the mosque and the synagogue and the church. We have the twinning of the mosque and synagogue between the Jewish community and the Muslim community. We have a dialogue between the Muslim community and the Christian community, whether with the Presbyterian, whether with the Catholic or Methodist and so forth. And therefore, I do believe that we should continue to educate our community and to make a promise, all of us as faith leaders, that none of us will use the podium and used our sermon to be a place where we spread hatred. We're going to teach our community to love and to care about their fellow Americans, regardless of what their faith may be, because we have one faith and one faith. We all human. We all created by God equally, and all of us, we have to show that we are brothers and sisters.
You know, Muhammad, I try to work on tolerance and reconciliation. I'll tell you one place it breaks down for me, and that is these people who keep saying that moderate Muslims are not doing enough to condemn the extremists in Islam. And I want to say, in a way that perhaps you can't, that simply is not true. Moderate Muslims are speaking loudly, regularly, forcefully, and unfortunately, the media are not always listening or not always reporting. When you speak publicly, what are you saying to people during this difficult time?
You know, I just gave a talk last night here in my mosque about where we stand as Muslims when we see this kind of violence taking place. And I said that we have always to remind ourselves that those people are not representing us. They don't represent Islam. And we should always tell our children, don't ever think any one of those people, they're doing the right things in terms of Islam. They do not represent the teaching of the Holy Quran, nor the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A cult of terror cannot be a religion. But at the same time, I'm saying to the public that there's many, many American Muslims, imams and leaders, who have condemned the act of violence and terrorism over and over again. And if you look to the media today, social media, you will see almost every major leader of Muslim in America have condemned ISIS actions mm-hmm. of taking innocent people's life.
Right.
I have it in my Facebook. I have it in my Twitter account. But people sometimes they don't see it or they don't read it. There are many press conferences about this issue. But what I'm saying to myself that we can overcome all of this by united together as human beings, as humanity, not by division, mm-hmm. not by hatred, not to try to create more friction between all of us. Let us speak together as Muslims, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, everyone. Let us hold hand and say, we're going to speak in one voice and we say no to violence. Yes, for collaboration of promoting common goods in our communities. We should not point fingers to a particular religion. Violence in every religion. We have problem with every communities. But this is a time to be united against violence, whatever it may be, rather than creating friction and division among all of us.
Imam Muhammad Majid is the immediate past president of ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America. Imam Majid, thank you so much for helping us to understand and for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, my friend.
Mike Papantonio is known as America's lawyer, but he is so much more than that. An insightful analyst of culture and politics. He's the host of Ring of Fire Radio. He's frequently called upon to comment on the day's news on television and radio programs. As busy as he is, we've got a distinct advantage in getting him to sit down for a few minutes with us, since we are his grateful guests in the Ring of Fire studios this week. Pap, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Not only my guest, but a longtime friend. Let's not forget who was there in Air America days when nobody else wasn't. You know, it was me and you.
You're exactly right. Well, look, I mean, it's that time of the year. Labor Day's behind us now. The campaign season is swinging into high gear. What are you keeping your eye on?
It's kind of the backstory of midterms. We find out that the Koch brothers had their advisor, I call him their private little hitman. His name is Mr. Fink. And one thing that Mr. Fink said is the way that they're going to win is to scare everybody in believing that if they don't win, that fascism is going to prevail in America. And I thought that that was an interesting way for him to talk about the midterm elections, that, gee whiz, you better get out and you better vote Republican, because if you don't, fascism is going to prevail. What was so sad about that is that in that room when he was talking to these folks, these are mega billionaires sitting all around Mr. Fink when he has this discussion, and they know first it takes megabucks, industrialists and banking capitalists, to replace government control with control by industrialists and banking capitalists. Those were the people in the room, Weldon. Mm. They are the fascists. These folks in that room know that this is always accomplished by spreading around mind-boggling amounts of money that can infect the media. They own the media. People in that room, they own the media. Where the media doesn't report the truth about corporate industrialists and their attempt to usurp government, the people in that room that Mr. Fink was talking to, they also said that there has to be enough money to spread around where major check and balances don't take place in institutions, where you have government checks and balances that are replaced by industrialists, governing bodies from the very ground up. And here's what we're going to see in midterms. you're going to see them looking at elections that have to do with everything from dog catcher up to the governor. Now, the average progressive, because they're so naive, because Democrats have talked them into being naive, all we're paying our attention to is what's happening in the White House, what's happening in the Senate. We're looking at the big shiny things. But the guys that Mr. Fink was talking to in that room, well, they know this. They want to win from the bottom up. They want to win governors and state legislatures all the way up to national bodies such as Congress and the Senate, because that's how fascism prevails. You got to start from ground up. That is one of the hallmarks of fascism. That's how you do it. Just as important, they have to capture the judicial system from the ground up. How do they know that? Because they saw it happen in Berlin. They saw it happen in Italy. They've seen it with Pinochet. They've seen it time and time again. They know exactly how you go about bringing fascism together, and you got to have the judiciary.
How powerful are the culture war issues going to be as tools for inducing that fear and trying to win votes?
Well, the cultural wars is where it all started. The culture wars was where you had Lee Atwater understand that the racist, the evangelical, really frenzy fringe of the evangelicals in the South can be made to do anything if you can just scare the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. And so Lee Atwater went about scaring them. And one way that he went about scaring them was to say exactly what's being said by Mr. Fink in that room. Let me come back to Mr. Fink.
Okay.
Mr. Fink said fascism is here. That is exactly what Lee Atwater used to talk about. Hmm. Lee Atwater used to talk about they're coming to your church. Mm-hmm. They want to change your religion. They're coming for your guns, just like they did in Berlin. Mr. Fink's speech to the fascists that were in that room was exactly the speech that Lee Atwater was given to the populace when he started his Southern strategy. Here, the industrialists have arrived at this point where they're almost there. They've almost arrived, because the major institutions that they have control over at this point, they actually control the civil justice process. They control the military. And what happens when you have such control over the media, over the judiciary, over the government agencies, over the regulatory agencies, to where you have such control, to where you can actually make telephone calls and you can make the civil enforcement organizations do what you want them to do? The people in that room that Mr. Fink was talking to, they know that that's kind of the last part of it. The real irony here is that the average American has such a small understanding about what's happening around them day to day. Day to day, you have them wondering, well, what, you know, what's Kim Kardashian going to wear? You know, it's like the frog in the pot boiling water. They don't even see that all this is happening right before their eyes.
Yeah. Well, I take it that we're going to see the influence of unregulated campaign contributions again this time.
Oh, absolutely. One reason is because you're going to see this midterm very theme-based, okay? In order to have a theme-based campaign, which is Obama is inept in foreign policy, and that inept quality flows all the way down to the senators and the congressmen, they have to find something to grab a hold of, right? And so right now, I'm telling you, the theme is going to be fascism is here, the liberals are going to bring it to us, but it takes a lot of money to deliver that. In that room was probably 70% of all the money that flows to these PACs, 70% of all the money that flows to political organizations, to the Republican Party. In that room was the money. And so Fink was trying to say to them, we can confuse the American public to where they believe that liberalism is the same as fascism. Mm-hmm. We can convince them that socialism is the same as fascism. Now, you and I know how ridiculous that is. But the average person out there watching Fox television reads and comprehends on something like a 6th or 7th grade level. I think those are the numbers. Mm-hmm. And they can be sold that. Now, you're going to see that theme. Mr. Mm-hmm. Fink launched that theme in the room 2 days ago. And you're going to see that theme again and again come up throughout this election, the midterm.
Pap, do you think some of the foreign crises challenging the Obama administration will have a significant impact on voters in both the state and local elections?
It certainly will. And right now what's scaring me is the Democrats do what they typically do, and that is not to react, not to push back. Democrats, as you and I have talked about so often, are so willing to show up at a gunfight with a knife. and it just doesn't work, the bullets travel a lot faster. So the Democrats...
I don't believe I used that analogy.
Well, I think we've said it maybe one way or another. That's my analogy. And the way this all works, Weldon, is this. The Democrats have a great talking point here. You know what it is? The Democrats could be saying, you know, as we hear the John McCain types criticizing Obama, we need to remember that John McCain helped invent ISIS. We need to put some of this blame back on the people who decided all the way back in Afghanistan days that we need to arm the Afghans against the Soviets. And that out of there came al-Qaeda and, more importantly, came bin Laden. We need to remind the American public that these big mouths, the John McCain's, the Lindsey Graham types, the Wolfowitz types, the Dick Cheney types, these war pimps, we need to remind them that they made ISIS what it was, because what ended up happening was this. Out of Afghanistan, you had a merger between ISIS and al-Qaeda. When al-Qaeda and ISIS merged together, the first thing they did is they used that force to try to knock down Libya. Remember that. They joined hands. They said, we're going to knock down Gaddafi, and we're going to become stronger. We're going to have the Islamic State spread all over the world, and we're going to start right here. So at that point, what did the United States do? I've got pictures of John McCain with his arms around ISIS soldiers saying that these are the people we really need to be able to trust. Okay? We've got pictures of all of these war pimp politicians who armed ISIS, who armed al-Qaeda, and said, go get them, because at that moment, we thought that was going to be a good thing. Next thing we know, al-Qaeda sees ISIS as such a fanatical threat that they all start distancing themselves, right? But that doesn't stop the United States from embracing them. The next thing we know, we have ISIS going after Assad. Right? Syria. Mm-hmm. And we love that. McCain shows up again, puts his arms around ISIS, says, these are our guys. These are their freedom fighters. No, these are the people that just beheaded two of our journalists and have massacred thousands and thousands of people. But this is John McCain's guys. These are his people, you see. Mm-hmm. When they start invading Syria, we arm them more. We give them more arms. We give them more money. We give them more bombs. We give them more moral support. We build ISIS.
What about domestic issues, the fallout of Ferguson, Missouri on race, the paralysis of Congress, the ongoing border situation?
You know what the numbers show?
What?
People don't care. They don't care. If you look at the numbers, Ferguson was a story that seemed hot. Now, the population who understands what's happening to them, if you have African-Americans, Latinos that don't understand what kind of a metaphor we can look at when we look at Ferguson, and they can look at what's going to happen to them in years to come, they're concerned. Now, that may get them to show up. If they show up, that's wonderful, because they're protecting themselves. Average American does not care. Average American does not care that we don't have a solution to the border right now. You know why? Because the Republicans are pushing this whole issue with ISIS, and they're trying to put it on our president. And what are they doing? They're doing exactly what we've seen them do. Scare tactics, scare tactics. Soccer mom? Soccer mom, you better be terrified. ISIS is coming for you, okay? And we got a president, and we got Democrats that don't know what to do with it. Democrats, rather than fighting back, sit there and take it, because they just don't get it still.
Pap, I can't have us sitting here talking in Florida without asking you if there's anything specific to Florida election year politics that you need to mention.
Well, you got Charlie Crist right now fighting for his life. He's fighting for his life when you have a governor that's put more people out of work than we can count, that's closed down the high-speed rail, that gave more tax benefits to corporations than any governor in the history of this state, that has cut down education, destroyed unions, destroying our environment. We've got a guy that's so dense where it comes to environmental issues, they had to bring in a professor to talk to him about what climate change was all about. The entire time they were talking, that 20 minutes, Governor Scott never asked one question. He sat there with that goofy, idiotic smile on his face, understanding he doesn't really care because he's in the pocket of corporate America. And right now you have Charlie Crist that is actually down in the polls and can't buy enough ad time to win this election, because Governor Scott and all of his corporate types have bought all the airtime up.
Mike Papantonio is a popular guest on TV news programs. You can see why, and he is the host of Ring of Fire Radio. Thank you, as always, for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and for once again welcoming us back to this Ring of Fire studio.
You're welcome here anytime you want.
Even as some conservative religious denominations have received criticism for their persistent exclusion of women from leadership roles, there has also long been what some have labeled a stained glass ceiling, even in more progressive churches. But recently, we've seen that finally start to change. And I'm happy to have the chance to talk about that news with historian, theologian, and author Dr. Diana Butler Bass. Diana, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. It's good to be back with you.
A recent Washington Post article highlighted the ascent of three women faith leaders to prominent big city pulpits in recent months. The Reverend Shannon Johnson Kirshner in Chicago, the Reverend Amy Butler in New York, a good friend of mine, and the Reverend Ginger Gaines Sorelli in Washington, D.C. Now, why is this a news story?
Partly it's news because those three churches, Foundry, Fourth Pres in Chicago, and Riverside in New York, those are what historians know to be the original mega churches of Protestantism. So back in the early 20th century, up through the mid-20th century, these were significant, huge congregations that had amazing influence on the culture and politics and the theology of all their different denominations. So to see three women come to three such historic pulpits at the same moment really signals an enormous change for the mainstream, or what I call the brand name Protestant communities in America. Mm-hmm. So it is a very big deal.
Diana, do you think there's something unique that female faith leaders bring to mainline congregations?
I do, because once upon a time, feminist leaders thought that feminism was merely a matter of getting women into significant places of leadership in existing institutions and organizations. Mm-hmm. And so sort of the goal of feminism, I think it probably as recently as the 1960s and early 1970s, was to simply make sure that women achieved the same level of leadership as men. But I think that what we've learned in the years since the 1960s and 1970s is that feminism is often not just about leadership in institutions, but it's about different sorts of experiences and sensibilities coming to play in those organizations and creating space of risk and change so that traditional institutions and communities can accept and be broadened by those different sensibilities and a different kind of experience of the world. And so I actually do think that women, as well as persons of color and people who might come from other kinds of marginalized communities, like people who grow up poor and might become a pastor in a traditionally wealthy denomination or wealthy church, that those people have different ways of seeing the world. And that has an impact on what they preach, how they serve their communities, and the kinds of missions that their communities wind up doing.
So, Diana, what do you say if these women consult with you, as they likely do, what do you say to them about how best to seize this moment in history?
Oh, well, I actually think about that in relationship to my own work. So I'm only in my early 50s, and when I was in graduate school, it was still a really odd thing for a woman to be getting a PhD in religion. And so a big part of my own personal spiritual journey has been incorporating into my vocation and into my career the passions of second wave feminism, which was going on when I was very small, but then to try to live them out in this cultural setting of people paying attention to women and women trying to bring these sensibilities and experiences to bear in their work. So I would actually tell all three of them something I suspect they already know, and that is how we live here, how we embrace our failures and how we celebrate successes, how we learn from the voices around us, how we relate to the past. All of these things is part of the spirituality of leadership that I think is growing right now. And there are no easy answers here that women who are in their 40s and 50s who are achieving these kinds of leadership positions across the board in society, we're all trying to figure this out. And one of the places I tend to look is I tend to look for women leaders who are just a little older than myself and see how they've navigated some of these same streams. And in that sense, I think someone like Hillary Clinton continues to be a huge teacher for women who want to change the world. And so I'm constantly watching people like her and trying to see what's she doing right? What do folks respond to? How has she reacted to her own failures or the failures of her husband, for example? And how does she bring those experiences to bear on what it means to be a senator or secretary of state? So those are the kinds of things that I would remind my friends about, is that we don't know really how to do this, but whatever we are doing becomes a model for the women who come behind us.
Okay, I want to flip that for a second, because I think you're exactly right in an emphasis on the whole idea of spirituality of leadership. But I'm also concerned about the spirituality of fellowship, of congregationalship, because some congregations need to know the benefit of being challenged in new ways. What do you say about that?
Congregations, and really even leaders. I mean, in some ways, leaders are always followers. Certainly in great religious traditions, the best leaders understand themselves to be followers of a tradition or a great teacher like Jesus or Buddha or whatever. And so in a sense, we're all needing this constant reminder that we're all followers and that we all have to be in a position of learning and taking risks that followership implies. And so the leader of a congregation holds that out in some unique way for that specific community. And so I think that, you know, that would be one of the first things that I would remind any congregation of, is that, you know, none of us really knows how to lead, and none of us really knows how to follow. But we're called to be both. We're called to always follow the examples of the great saints and shamans that have gone before us, and we are also called to lead others into wisdom, goodness, kindness, and beauty to make the world a better place. And so I think if we remember that this is really a shared human activity, and you can work that into a congregation's life and view of itself, that takes you a very long way down the road in creating congregations that are willing to embrace risk.
Dana, if you can, I'd like you to put these recent changes in context. Do you have a ballpark estimate even of what percentage of Americans participate in faith communities that continue to be restrictive of women in ministry and leadership?
Well, we know that about 22% or so of the population are evangelical Protestants. And in most evangelical Protestant communities, women as pastors, especially senior pastors or denominational leaders, is still relatively rare. And we also know that about 22% of the population is Roman Catholic, and most of us are aware that the Catholic Church has very strong strictures against women in leadership. So that means somewhere about 40 to 45% of the population identifies with denominations that are strongly to moderately against women in leadership. So then you've got about 10 or 15% of the population who are atheists, agnostics, et cetera. They're kind of outside the question. They think it's probably silly that anybody would have any questions on these things. And that means that there's probably then about well, I don't know, the Jewish community generally very strongly supportive of women in leadership, the mainline Protestant community, some evangelicals. And then there are the Catholics who are arguing against their church on this issue who mm-hmm. want to see women in leadership.
Yeah.
So I suspect it might come up to as much as 35 to 40% of the population on the other side that are strongly to extraordinarily supportive of women in leadership. So I think it's a pretty divided picture right now.
Will that change anytime soon, particularly change for the better?
I think it already has changed for the better. I think those numbers have shifted hugely over mm-hmm. our lifetimes. And I can see it shifting among younger adults. I have a daughter who's 16, and for them to talk about the fact that a woman can't do something is kind of silly.
Yeah.
So I do see this long arc of change, especially over the course of the last century. Mm-hmm. I think the most dynamic place of change right now is probably in the evangelical community,
yeah.
where younger evangelicals are pulling away from the traditional position of their parents against women in leadership in rather large numbers. And I think that their energy helps to account for some of the phenomenon. So I think those things are changing.
Diana Butler Bass is an independent scholar specializing in American religion and culture, and she's the author of 8 books, the latest of which is Christianity After Religion, The End of Church, and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening. Diana, I've missed talking with you lately, and I'm really glad that you could come on today. It's always enlightening to hear you. And so thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
No, you're welcome.
Before we go, this week, a federal court judge in my home state of Louisiana broke what had come to look like an unending winning streak for marriage equality in our country. Judge Martin Fellman's decision was chock full of far-right talking points. After making sure to refer to homosexuality as a lifestyle choice, Judge Fellman wandered around the offensive rhetorical fields of aunts marrying nieces, and even fathers marrying their children. As Ian Millhiser carefully demonstrates in a thorough analysis published at thinkprogress.org, Judge Fellman gets into even deeper rhetorical trouble once he ventures to use some big legal words and reference legal precedents. But what's most noteworthy, perhaps, is an argument we've heard before in this particular culture war debate, albeit only in losing arguments so far, and that is that same-gender marriage is a new phenomenon and that it therefore is not entitled to the kind of constitutional protections afforded to more historical concepts. Some have even expanded this reasoning to conclude that since the Founding Fathers knew nothing of same-gender marriage, they couldn't have possibly intended for it to be protected by the U.S. Constitution. Now, taken at face value, that might actually be true, especially if the U.S. Constitution concerned itself with the preservation of institutions in the exact form they held 300 years ago. But the Bill of Rights, the part of the Constitution we are most directly concerned with here, focuses not on the rights of institutions or even, believe it or not, of corporations. No. The focus is on the individual, the human being, the American. And here, Judge Fellman and the far-right anti-gay organizations that sent celebratory fundraising emails immediately after the ruling run into serious rhetorical trouble. Because individuals have been discriminated against for at least as long as they've been getting married. And unless we reject the fundamental constitutional premise that individuals possess innate rights and freedoms, we don't ourselves possess the ability to pick and choose which of those rights deserve protection. Yes, same-gender marriage is a relatively new phenomenon. But that's not because it's the latest trend. Rather, it's precisely because generation after generation of LGBT persons was so profoundly discriminated against and mostly forced so deeply into the closet out of fear for their very lives that the dream of publicly sanctioned marriage equality was just that, an impossible dream. Do you think that on the very day the U.S. Constitution was signed, there weren't Americans already dreaming that dream? You bet there were. So this week, the U.S. Constitution suffered a setback in Louisiana. News reports indicate an appeal is already in the works. And if equality advocates are no longer batting 1,000, we're still way above 900. And believe me, it's just a matter of time. For now, I'll just repeat here what I said in the official Interfaith Alliance response to the ruling. Louisianians will not know true religious freedom until every marriage, whether performed in a house of worship or in a secular space, even on the 50-yard line of LSU, is given full legal recognition. And I will continue to make sure that in my own church in Monroe, Louisiana, we will continue to welcome members of the LGBT community, and I will continue to celebrate the reality of their marriages in the eyes of God, even if governmental leaders in our state look away. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Without the financial support of State of Belief listeners, this wouldn't be happening right now. This show would not be possible. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters and to do it today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that we strive to present every week is virtually impossible to find somewhere else, anywhere else. So please consider helping us to keep this important work going. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook or Twitter. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you always to tell others about the show. Engage them in the discussion and encourage them to contribute to the discussion after listening to it. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And please join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was.